From news of the High Court, we turn to a question of law and medicine. Colleen Hauser and her 13-year-old son Daniel are back home after a week on the run. They had fled Minnesota after a court ordered Daniel to begin chemotherapy treatments for Hodgkin's lymphoma. The Hausers favor addressing the illness with nutritional supplements and alternative treatments. Daniel Hauser is now in protective custody, but was allowed to stay at his parents' home under watch by a deputy. This case has drawn national attention and reignited the debate over who has the right to choose medical treatment for minors. For more on this, we turn to Arthur Kaplan. He's a professor of bioethics and director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and he joins us from his home in Philadelphia. Also with us is Michael Farris. He's a constitutional lawyer and the president of ParentalRights.org. It's an organization that defends rights of parents to raise their children as they see fit with minimal government influence. He joins us from his office in Virginia. Welcome to both of you. Professor Kaplan, I'd like to start with you. In this case, Daniel Hauser suffers from Hodgkin's lymphoma, and as I understand it, the survival rate with chemotherapy for that is about 90%. So why would a parent's belief system carry any weight at all in a case like this?
Well, parents do get tremendous discretion to raise their kids to do what they believe is best for them. It's in a rare situation that you wind up trying to override that. And this is one of those because, like insulin and diabetes, antibiotics and meningitis, chemotherapy really works well on this particular form of childhood cancer. 90 to 95% success rate, survival out at 80% at 10 years. So, yes, parents can do as they wish most of the time, but they can't do things that are going to lead to the immediate death of their child.
Now, how much influence does the child get? Any influence at all?
The child would have some influence. Basically, you're looking at a situation where the closer you get to the legal age of consent to 18, you have more input from the child. But Daniel Hauser has learning disabilities. He can't read. He has a lot of cognitive impairment. So he's almost a special case. He can't really make his own views known.
Michael Farris, let me turn to you. How do you interpret the ethical obligation of doctors versus the parents' right to refuse treatment or to decide treatment?
Well, I think that the balance should be heavily weighted on the side of the parents. But I do believe that the judge made the correct decision in this particular case, that when it's a life and death situation and there is no viable alternative treatment, if the parents had come up with a plan that was nearly as successful as chemotherapy and, you know, just was a different way of accomplishing the same thing, I think that the deference should have been given to the family. But in this particular case, this is the kind of thing where the government does have the ability and does have the right to intervene. Unfortunately, what I see going on is the government intervening in cases and doctors intervening in cases that are a lot less dramatic than this and a lot less worthy of government intervention or doctor intervention.
We have to take a short break, but in a moment we'll continue our conversation about the rights of parents to determine medical treatment with attorney Michael Farris and bioethicist Arthur Kaplan. Stay with us on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. I'm Lynn Neary, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away this week. Coming up, with the school year ending, many young people are looking for summer jobs, but they're not the only ones. With unemployment at a 25-year high, many of the jobs typically reserved for youth are being coveted and filled by adults. More on the summer job squeeze in a moment. But first, we continue our conversation about balancing medical ethics and parents' rights. The case of 13-year-old cancer patient Daniel Hauser and his family's resistance to traditional treatment has put the issue back on the front page. Still with us are attorney Michael Farris of ParentsRights.org and Arthur Kaplan, director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Kaplan, other than a life or death situation, at what point would you say that authorities should intervene when a parent refuses treatment for a child?
Well, when you try to look at four dimensions, how imminent is the death or severe disability going to be to the child? Is it something that is going to take place within the next month, 2 months, 3 months, or are we talking about something that might take years and years? There are parents, for example, who refuse HIV treatment for their kids, and while doctors may push and might even try to go to court, they usually don't win those. The kid usually goes without the HIV treatment, although it can imperil their lives, but it's not imminent. You also are looking at the age of the child, so if they have something to say at 17 years, 11 months, and 29 days, you're probably listening more closely to what they might want. Is there an effective treatment? So insulin, diabetes, that really works 100% of the time. We know we can treat it. If you're in a diabetic coma, you got to do something right away. Parents who don't do that are going to get court ordered to do it, and I think that's right. Then the last dimension is, what do you do in terms of the alternative proposed? Ionized water and sweat lodges are not going to do anything for cancer, even Native American people who Dan Houser's parents claim to be inspired by. Say that's not the way to go with a cancer. So they're not proposing an alternative that has any efficacy at all. You take all those dimensions together, that's how you sort of weigh when you're going to intervene.
How do you interpret this, Michael Farris? When would you say was the moment where the government might have a right to intervene other than a life or death situation? Or is there no, if life or death is not involved, do you think that the government shouldn't intervene at all?
I think that you need to be able to intervene where there is a serious, I mean, the legal standard is there's a compelling governmental interest. That's not the terminology that science uses, but that the law uses. And it's something of the highest order and is not otherwise served. The example that I would give you to the contrary is a situation that happened in Tennessee in April where a father took his 13-year-old son to the doctor for a prescription drug interaction, and the doctor took the father aside, asked him if he could do a test on the son for illegal drug use. And the dad said, sure. But when the test came back, citing the HIPAA regulations on privacy and the doctor's own judgment, he just refused to give the father the results. And there was nothing to do with parental abuse or anything of that sort. Parents are getting taken out of the loop in so many decisions. And if anything spoke to the life or death situation of that boy, he needed to have his parents know what was going on with the illegal drugs so that they could intervene and help.
Mr. Farris, sometimes the disagreement over treatment is based on religious beliefs, sometimes not. But does the religious argument hold more weight in court?
It shouldn't. From a legal perspective, even though I've defended religious liberty cases for 30 years, religious liberty should be treated under the fundamental rights doctrine, which requires a showing of the compelling interest. But parental rights also are a fundamental right and should receive the same level of treatment. So it gets consideration, but it isn't a final trump card. There is always the ability of the government in the very severe case to overcome it when there's interest of the highest order, and this chemo case certainly fit that bill.
Professor Kaplan, these kinds of refusals come up periodically, as we mentioned, for religious reasons, also for sort of straightforward, differences of opinion about the best course of treatment. And another example that's been in the news lately is parents refuse to get their children, small children, immunized. Are the same principles involved in that debate, or is that a completely different kind of situation?
It is a different debate. It's an interesting one, but it's a different one. Vaccination is going to prevent something from happening. Nobody's in immediate danger of measles or mumps or diphtheria. You're certainly increasing the odds that you or people you come in contact with are going to get it. But from a public health point of view, we have built-in exemptions by law letting people refuse vaccines. So it's hard to compel a vaccination when you've made an explicit exemption within the state laws, and parents usually invoke those, and that's how that happens. You can argue about whether it makes good sense in the age of swine flu to let people go without vaccination for some vaccines, but they certainly have that right. I wanted to make a slightly different point, Lynn. And this is something that Michael, I think, was edging toward, too. When you have these refusals of treatment by parents, there's a tendency to want to prosecute them, and, this woman ran away with Daniel, and I think that's a mistake. Daniel's 13, got a lot of cognitive impairment. He needs his parents. And whatever we think of their choices, and I don't think much of them in terms of treating this cancer, I understand why she may have panicked at the chemotherapy because it's very rough on the child. But put that aside. He needs an intact family, he's going to need his mom, especially given his particular cognitive problems. So I think you got to realize getting him the chemotherapy is half the battle. The victory is if you can get him the chemotherapy with an intact family.
Now, in this case, it sounds like the resolution, now that they have returned, that the resolution is that they are going to drop the charges, but that's still to be decided. Let me ask both of you, all of these kinds of questions, do they have to be handled on a case-by-case basis, or is there a way to legislate these cases when a parent, or to decide for is there possible to create a law that would say when a parent or a doctor has the final decision-making power? Mr. Ferris?
I don't think so. I think that you can only enact general principles in law, and the general principles should be that parents have a fundamental right to make decisions for their children. And it has to be case by case because there are just too many factors, too many variables, and there's going to be disagreements. And it really shouldn't be up to doctors or parents in the final analysis. It's got to be up to judges.
Mr. Ferris, we're going to have to stop you right there because we're out of time. Thanks to both of you for
joining
us this morning. Arthur Kaplan is a professor of bioethics and director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He joined us from his home in Philadelphia. And Michael Ferris is a constitutional lawyer and the president of parentalrights.org, and he joined us from his office in Virginia. Thanks to both of you.